on radio, online and on mobile. This is Sports World on the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Delith Lloyd and you're listening to a special Sports World podcast where I'll be delving deep into golf's relationship with race. Now, back in 1975, Lee Elder braved death threats to become the first African-American golfer to play at the Masters. It was one of the last colour barriers in US sport and made him a hero to many black sportsmen and women, including Tiger Woods. But 45 years on, and in the wake of the death of George Floyd, what progress has been made to make golf more inclusive and accessible to the black community? Well, later we'll hear from Joseph Bramlett about his experiences of being one of only four black golfers currently playing on the men's PGA Tour. Bramlett was the first black golfer to graduate from the tour's qualifying school since Adrian Stills in 1985. Jeff Benedict, journalist and co-author of the number one New York Times bestselling biography of Tiger Woods, will join us later to discuss whether golf has failed to capitalise on Tiger's success and whether Tiger himself has done enough to promote diversity in the sport. We'll also be hearing from Vernell Bennett, the president and co-founder of the United Black Golfers Association, who's been telling me about the work his organisation's been doing to encourage more black people to take up golf at a grassroots level. So plenty to discuss for the final hour of Sports World. Let me introduce you to my first two guests who'll be alongside me for the next hour. Maurice Allen, who was the first African-American player to become world long drive champion in 2018, and the current LPGA tour player Mariah Stackhouse, who was the youngest African-American woman to compete in the US Open and first African-American woman to compete in the Curtis Cup. Hi to you both, first of all. Really glad you can join us. Maurice, if I can start with you. You've described yourself as a black man in a white sport. What do you mean by that?
Well, first, thank you for having me on the program. But when we talk about that, the difference is golf in the United States is slightly different than in most places that I traveled. The public side of golf is very diverse for the most part. You can go to a public course anywhere, almost in any major city, any major metropolitan area. And golf is reasonably diverse. When you go to the esteemed country clubs, no matter where you are, that's where you start to see a huge difference. There are not many black members. Traditionally, if you do see black people, they're working. Unfortunately, historically, it's always been in the kitchen or maybe sometimes not even in the valet and things of that nature, but never in positions of power where you see black people. And then on the social standpoint, you don't see many of them as members. They're not looked at as members and things of that nature. If I went to a golf course and Mariah went to a golf course, we're paraded around kind of like albino tigers or something to that extent. It's just, hey, I know this person, and we're treated differently than comparison if any normal person who wasn't a professional athlete, just a normal person in business and industry, went to a country club. They would really get a lot of probably normally awkward looks and things of that nature, is because it's just not the norm. And unfortunately, that's the case here in the United States.
What about you, Mariah? Does that ring true? What was your experience as a young girl breaking into the sport of golf?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's definitely, you know, Maurice makes several points about once you get to the country club level, you know, diversity definitely starting to shrink a little bit. But when I think about my experiences in the game of golf and kind of getting introduced to it, you know, I started off practicing in Atlanta at a couple of small public courses in predominantly black communities on the south side of Atlanta. And so I don't think that, you know, I noticed that as much. And then once I started competing in junior tournaments, you know, it's interesting when you play local tours like I did in the Atlanta area, Atlanta Junior Golf Association, some Georgia State Golf Association junior events, you're competing with the same people week in and week out. And so you actually become really good, you know, buddies with everyone around you. So when I think about my experience growing up playing competitive golf, I think about being excited to run to tournaments and play with the same friends that I played with every single week. And so that's kind of how I remember my upbringing in the game of golf. And I think that growing up on the south side of Atlanta and playing those courses probably, you know, added to an extra level of comfort for me, you know, playing those south side golf courses in those predominantly Black communities.
Yeah. I mean, was there any racism at all then? Because obviously you mentioned you had a good group of friends growing up, but were you open to any sort of overt racism?
Overt, I would definitely say that I don't recall any of those experiences growing up. And if they did exist, I think maybe my parents protected me from them. They were definitely with me most of the time at my junior tournaments and everything growing up. But, you know, I think I started playing competitive golf at the age of 6. And so the people that I was competing with, I knew them 6 to 10 to 15 to 18. And I saw them, you know, at every tournament we played. And so I think that kind of junior familial atmosphere that you develop when you've been playing with people for so long, you know, kind of takes over that experience. And then from the practice perspective, playing at public courses, playing at the semi-private courses that I moved on to play with in my early teenage years, it was much the same thing. The courses had like kind of junior tour organizations, and we would just always play and compete against each other and growing as competitive golfers. And so I think that afforded a pretty positive experience to me.
What about you, Maurice? Not as positive of Mariah. I mean, just give me examples of racism that you've encountered during your career.
Absolutely, completely different. I didn't get into golf until I was an adult. So at the age of 28, you know, you don't take your parents with you to tournaments. That just doesn't happen. That would be a little
weird. Would get a lot of looks, wouldn't it?
that would be a very strange thing. But you know, for me, but you have to understand also in the same sentence, long drive and golf are not the same sports. Golf is a worldwide sport. Long drive is heavy in a few countries, US being one of them. But when you step outside of the United States, especially when I first started outside of Scandinavia and South Africa, it really wasn't a large sport. And then the places where it took place in the United States were all rural areas. There were no major metropolitan cities. So looking back at it now, it was honestly a recipe for disaster. When you think about it, it wasn't in progressive areas. So being called all kinds of names, even having it where I remember my cousin went to a tournament once and a guy, they said that my ball was out of bounds because the guy kicked it literally out of bounds. I had seen numbers changed in the middle of tournaments where, for instance, I hit the ball 365 and then they come back 10 minutes later and say, oh no, it was 359. Like that, how does that happen? You know, things of that nature. So from that part, it's different. I think the major parallels that you'll see, though, whether it be long drive or golf, is the absolute lack of sponsorship that you see with mm-hmm. Black golfers. Mariah doesn't know this, but I've made it very publicly, a very public statement about her as an individual with the pedigree that she has coming from Stanford, you know, being the anchor leg on that national championship team, all the publicity that she got. And if she had been a white woman, she would have gotten a lot more pub, a lot more sponsorship, a lot more press than she did, because she's absolutely an amazing, amazing golfer and a brilliant individual on top of that. So when you look at it as Black people, we've always been told that we have to have the total package. And when you have a Black woman who goes to Stanford, which is definitely one of the top 4 schools in the United States, hands down, finds a way to get through that rigorous academic program, keep her grades at the highest level, and play the highest level of golf. I don't know how much more of the total package you can get other than that. And that just, it's one of those things where it's crazy. I talked to a young lady, Nicola Bennett. Nicola Bennett, she lives in the UK right there with you all. And she was an amazing player, but because of her skin color, she wasn't able to get sponsors as well. It's just one of those things, you know, when you really look at golf as a whole, there has not been one single company that has marketed to the Black consumer. And it's never happened. There hasn't even been an acknowledgement of Black History Month through anybody in the golf arena, whether it be PGA of America, USGA, and go down the line with the OEMs. And they do some small stuff here and there, but it's not a true recognition of the accomplishments that people have made prior to today.
Wow. Well, Maurice and Mariah, stay with us. But let's hear now from one of only four Black golfers currently playing on the men's PGA Tour. Joseph Bramlett has a Black father and a white mother and was the first Black golfer to graduate from the tour's qualifying school since Adrian Stills in 1985. He's been telling me what it was like growing up with the game of golf as a Black man.
I was very fortunate growing up. I mean, I had two parents who were both pretty familiar with the game of golf and had the means to provide me with a golf course to play and practice at, provide me with opportunity for great coaching, mentoring. So my experience with the game of golf was not overly unfamiliar with a lot of other players on the PGA Tour in that regard. I think the differences for me probably had more to do socially. You know, when my dad and I would show up at the golf course, there really wasn't anybody else that looked like us. And I didn't have a lot of guys that I played with and practiced with that had some of those similarities with. So, you know, for me, there was kind of those two pieces that were pulling in opposite directions.
Did you ever encounter racism growing up in the sport?
Yeah, I've had some run-ins. I've tried to describe it in the past as probably a little bit more implicit than explicit racism. I didn't have the typical story that the Calvin Peets, the Lee Elders, the Charlie Siffords, I didn't have any kind of run-ins that those guys had to deal with. However, yeah, there's certainly been moments where Tiger talks about a lot when him and his father would step on the first tee, they would always get those looks, you know, and that was definitely something that I was very keen to and aware of growing up. And, you know, since then, there's always going to be some run-ins, you know, that's being a Black athlete in any kind of arena or crowd type sport. There's going to be, you know, little things that you hear and things people say that, unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do about, but just keep playing and keep going about our business.
Can the PGA do more, do you think? Can they make the sport more accessible across diverse backgrounds?
Yeah, I think they absolutely can. I think it's going to take a focused effort to do that. It's certainly something that I think they're starting to show an eye to and starting to show an interest for. And, you know, I think the aftermath of kind of how the last 6 months to a year have gone in our country, I think the tour has their attention on this. And I think it's going to take a focused effort. But yeah, I definitely think they can start to do more. And I think they will start to do more.
What can you do as a golfer, Joseph? You're in your early 30s. For other youngsters coming through, have you been able to exert your influence on them and guide them in the sport?
Yeah, I'd like to think I have. You know, I was taught very young that I got a lot of help along the way to get to where I want to get to in this game. And so when I have the opportunity, it's going to be my turn to pay that forward and help someone else along the way. And so I've certainly tried to mentor and assist any young Black golfers that I know and see. And any ones that I cross paths with, I'm always trying to help kind of move the needle along the way. So, yeah, I really just want to use my platform and level of influence in any way that I can. And I think it's really important for young kids to have heroes and people that they see on the PGA Tour that they identify with. So hopefully I can have success on the course and then that can translate.
I hope we're a way off from the end of your career. But if and when you do reach the end of your career, what would you like to be your legacy?
I would like to leave an impact on the game of golf where you start to see more Black players and more people of color playing at the top levels. I think that it's been quite a while and there's more Black golfers on the PGA Tour in the 70s and 80s than there have been in the last 40 years. So I definitely think there's some gaps that I hope to fill. And hopefully when my career is said and done, I can walk away from the game having left a positive impact and having introduced the game to a lot of kids who maybe wouldn't have seen themselves as playing golf.
What fundamentally needs to be done to increase those numbers, though, so that by the time it comes to the end of your career, you know, we are hopefully into double figures on the men's tour?
Well, it is an intricate process, but I think the big talking points is going to be access and availability, and then mentorship and learning how to make it as a professional golfer. I've befriended quite a few, you know, young black players throughout my lifetime, and they've got a lot of talent and a lot of ability, and a lot of them are just scrounging to try to find enough money to keep playing or to find, you know, facilities to practice at or opportunities to get the proper coaching. And golf is an individual sport, so you kind of have to figure out your path as you go, and that takes a really strong supporting cast. And I had a really strong support team on my way up to make it to the PGA Tour, as has probably every other player on the PGA Tour. So I think it's about trying to fill that support system for these young black golfers who are very talented, and really just trying to find the right path for them to make it.
That's Joseph Bramley. It's one of only four black golfers currently playing on the men's PGA Tour. Maurice Allen and Mariah Stackhouse still with me. Mariah, one line in that Joseph Bramley interview really stood out for me. Him saying, it's really important for young kids to have heroes and people on the PGA Tour that they identify with. Is that something that you feel perhaps as a sense of responsibility to be a role model for younger girls?
Absolutely. And I really appreciated hearing Joseph say that, because it's, I mean, a lot of what I listened to him say in that interview are thoughts that I also share about growing the game of women's golf and getting more young black girls not only interested in the sport, but continuing along to each level in the game of golf. And so, you know, it's responsibility that definitely feels more like opportunity than anything. And you definitely, it definitely helps to have someone that you identify with and to be able to look up to in the game of golf. I, you know, think about the courses that I grew up playing here in Atlanta. And I remember there were a couple junior golf programs. And I remember specifically two older black girls when I was little that would play and practice out at the golf course. And you know, I definitely looked up to them as big sisters, and they took me under their wing and let me hang around them and practice. And I used to love to show up at the golf course and go hang out with Jennifer and Amber. And I still remember that to this day, and what that meant to me to see them out there as well. And so I definitely take it as an opportunity to do the same and to reach back and extend a hand to everyone that comes behind me. And that can be through mentorship. That can be through interacting at golf tournaments when young black girls and boys come out to watch me play. But yeah, I echo everything. I echo what Joseph said there. I think it's an incredibly important opportunity that I embrace.
Fair to say, Mariah, that the LPGA Tour perhaps feels a little bit more progressive in terms of racial equality than the men's tour. I know the Rene Powell grant is something that provides a lot of black communities, doesn't it, with equipment and access to the sport. Is that a fair point, and is it a positive step?
Yes, I think that it's a fair point and a positive step for sure. And I think that when you take a look at the LPGA, it's an incredibly, from a player perspective, it's an incredibly diverse organization. We have players and members from over 30, 35 plus countries represented. And so I think that the LPGA has had the opportunity to grapple with for a very long time growing diversity and how to extend and embrace the communities that are showing up on our tour to play the game of golf. And so I definitely look forward to being able to support initiatives and those like the Rene Powell grant and what will come in the future to continue to expose more young black girls to the game of golf so that we can see that growing presence for young black women in the game of golf too.
And I suppose, Maurice, it's about accessibility, isn't it? I know this week Augusta National launched two scholarships in Lee Elder's name. We mentioned him at the start of the programme. One to a player who competes on the men's golf team at Payne College, which, of course, is historically
a black college and university located in Augusta, the other to a player on the women's team. So again, signs of progress may be small, but it is a sign of progress, is it not?
The thing is, you know, we've gotten to this point in life where we say that, you know, there are small steps and progressions. If you had a leak in your house, would you slowly turn it off or would you absolutely make sure it's shut off? And I think that's the only way that we move forward in life, is instead of getting these small progressions that are little things here and there that ultimately may fall by the wayside over time. We have to really combat this thing like the trauma that it has been. You know, when you go to an ER, they go through all types of things to save life, and they do life-saving measures. They crack open chest and things of that nature. They don't go in there and have a person in a medical emergency and stick a Band-Aid on it and say, well, we'll come back in a few minutes and figure this thing out and do steps over time. I think that, unfortunately, in this game, it has such a terrible history and has such a horrible past. The first thing that the game has to do is acknowledge the things that they've done wrong in the past. And from there, the healing can start. And then when you do start, you start on the most aggressive measure and the most aggressive path that is humanly possible. There are so many amazing black athletes, both men and women, that have given up on their dream or lost their dream because of the lack of support or the lack of access that they've had to these things. And at some point, we have to make sure that that doesn't continue. By giving one or two people an opportunity doesn't make up for the thousands that have lost it over this time. I'm in a group with probably 10 guys that I know that could have at least gotten to Corn Ferry or have some sense of a status on Corn Ferry. And all of them gave up because of the pretty much the carrot continuously being moved. As black athletes, we're always taught, well, if you do this, then these things will come. And then you accomplish these things, and then they move them again. They move the marker forward again. Then you accomplish those things, and the marker is moved every single time that you accomplish things. And then you look back at it, and there are people who don't have the same resume or don't have the same ability or the accomplishments, and they're getting the things that we never have gotten. And that still goes back to the point of people not utilizing the black consumer and finding a way to market towards the black consumer.
On radio, online, and on mobile, this is Sports World on the BBC World Service.
Still with me is Maurice Allen, the first African-American player to become World Long Drive Champion in 2018. The current LPGA Tour player, Mariah Stackhouse, who was the youngest African-American woman to compete in the US Open and first African-American woman to compete in the Curtis Cup. We're talking about golf's relationship with race. Mariah, must mention as well the Masters to you. Still, as of yet, no women's Masters in the pipeline. The Augusta National Women's Amateur was introduced last year, so inclusion at the course, it seems, needs to be extended beyond just racial equality, Mariah.
Yeah, I know. I can tell you, I can't remember exactly what the numbers were, but I think the viewer ratings for the amateur event, the women's amateur at Augusta National, if I'm not mistaken, was incredibly high, higher than the expectations had been. And so I think that just goes to show you, when you have a course that has the fame of Augusta National and something that people just love to see played on, I think that creates an incredible opportunity to promote the women's game at the amateur level. And I think you saw in the response, I think we all saw in the response to that event, how huge that was. People want to see golf played at Augusta National. And it was cool of them to see that done. You know, there's been a lot of history of oppression at Augusta National. To see that extended to women and in a direct statement, okay, we recognize that we've been slow to changes in the past. So, you know, let's try to correct that by bringing a women's event to the golf course. And I think that, you know, Maurice kind of highlighted it earlier, but it's not just about saying, you know, we're going to work to change. It's about doing something. And I think that was action. And I think the turnout for that was incredible.
Yeah, let's hope it is something that will happen at some point in the future. Cross fingers. Well, for the next few minutes, we're going to focus on the greatest black golfer and arguably the greatest black sportsman of all time.
He's ready now. Sends it into the cup and he clenches his fist and Woods is back as a major winner. Both arms aloft, everyone standing, roaring around the 18th green to salute the great Tiger Woods, the earliest of Masters finishes, the longest of waits, the most extraordinary of journeys, an epic comeback. And now Tiger Woods is a Masters winner once again.
Tiger Woods, they're winning an incredible 15th major title at last year's Masters. Maurice, I'll start with you. How big an inspiration has Tiger been to you?
None at all, to be honest with you. You know, I've publicly said it a million times. As a black male, he has done not – he hasn't done what the – what is expected of us when we're in positions like that. I think as an athlete, obviously he's remarkable from that standpoint, but unfortunately as a black person, you wear this badge, this honor that you have where you have to uplift and protect and look after those who are coming behind you. And I think in his interview after his first Masters win, when Oprah called him, you know, recognized him as black. And the first thing he said was he was Koblen Asian. That was the opportunity for him to embrace the blackness, embrace being a black male, but instead he took the America's guy road. And then when you look at the issues with George Floyd and how he was one of the last people to say something, that just speaks volumes to me as an individual, because I was someone who was mentored through my coach was a freedom rider. He went through the Fisk School, the Love School at Fisk and things of that nature during the civil rights. So I understood exactly where I was in my, I guess, fame or stardom or whatever influence that I have in understanding where I was in my particular part of my career as far as what I was going to do to make change for others and make sure that it didn't happen. I mean, but as a golfer, obviously, you can't deny the fact that he's one of the greatest who have ever done it. But as a black male, it leaves a lot of things wanting.
Mariah, do you share Maurice's views on that? Was he ever an inspiration for you, Tiger?
You know, Tiger, he is, you know, the greatest golfer to play the game of golf. And, you know, definitely, you know, he is a symbol of, you know, a term that has been kind of coined within the black community for people performing at the highest levels in their respective fields and industries, a symbol of black excellence. And so as a kid, you know, I started, my dad put a golf club in my hands at the age of 2. And Tiger has been on the scene really since I was a young golfer. And so just to, you know, see him physically on the TV screen, presenting to me, as a black man and to be dominating in the sport that I was growing to love. In that sense, as an athlete, he has absolutely, been, a huge inspiration to me. See dominate the game of golf. And so yeah, for me it's just strictly seeing a black man being the best golfer in the world for me, especially in my younger days. I mean, that was cool. I mean, he made golf cool. In the high school that I went to, you know, I definitely could have been potentially teased for, you know, playing golf. It wasn't a sport that was before Tiger seen as something that we would do. But because he was there and because he succeeded, you know, it allowed me to get that support from my peers growing up playing golf.
Well, let's bring in Jeff Benedict, journalist and co-author of the number one New York Times bestselling biography of Tiger Woods. Jeff, great to have you with us. I know Damon Hack, the presenter of the Golf Channel's Morning Drive, describes Tiger as a great gift and a great curse in terms of broadening the appeal of golf to the black community. Are those words that you agree with, do you think?
I'm not entirely sure what he meant by that, so I'm going to pass on saying whether I agree with it or not. What I would say, though, is that I think it's important to consider two things. Tiger's father, Earl, who had an enormous influence on him, basically was his influence through all of his childhood years, put a cocoon around him. His father was the victim of a lot of racism, starting in his early childhood, through school, through college, through the army. Basically, at every different juncture of Earl Woods' life, he confronted overt racism, sort of in-your-face racism that had a big impact on how he taught his son about race and what he said to his son about race. And I think if you go back and look at early Tiger, when I say early, I mean when he's in high school and there's footage of him talking about race, he talked about it a lot differently then when he lived at home with his mom and dad and was really under the complete tutelage of his father than the way he talked about it when he became a pro. And I think it's important to remember who became one of his biggest influences and role models when he moved out of his house and became a pro, and that was Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan was the premier athlete in the United States, and he had a reputation, very well known, for avoiding anything controversial. He, in fact, was criticized pretty sharply early in his career for avoiding weighing in on issues about social justice, politics, race. He never did that. And I think that that had a big impact on Tiger, because Tiger's a kid when Michael starts to sort of put his arm around him and start to influence and start to show him the way he conducted himself. Now, Jordan has obviously changed a lot. He's different now than he was then. But that's really who was a big guiding influence on him when he joined the PGA Tour. That's who he was hanging around with the most. And so I just think in terms of markers, it's important to look at who had influence over him, who had his ear. And there's a big difference between Earl Woods and Michael Jordan in terms of how they looked at race.
Did Tiger do enough to promote black golf then when he was at the peak?
Look, he's always going to be susceptible to being criticized for not doing more. But if you go back and look, the amount of things that he did, he actually was touring the country with his dad. Now, this was something his dad started and his dad was the impetus for, but Tiger did it. They put on clinics in communities across America where there had never been golf clinics. Untold thousands of kids that got exposed to golf through an outreach effort that he and his father started and now is much more entrenched. And he's got a whole foundation that does that today. But look, he never openly embraced the fact that he was an outlier, and that there certainly was he had a bully pulpit, so to speak, that he never embraced and took advantage of. He was not like Muhammad Ali. And the reason I mention Muhammad Ali is because I think he's probably the only other athlete that may have had a stage as big as Tiger's. And obviously we know what Muhammad Ali did. And so a lot of times Tiger gets compared to him in terms of his activism or lack of activism. And obviously, whenever you put those two together, one looks a lot worse than the other one in terms of what they did in their community.
Mm. Maurice, I mean, we've heard your views on it. So obviously, you mentioned that the death of George Floyd and how Tiger was one of the very last few golfers to mention his reaction to it. Is there a feeling, a sense perhaps that he has to conform to what is or what was a white sport?
I think in the beginning, in his initial debut on the PGA Tour, the sense to conform may have been a necessity because now we're talking about financial. OK, we're talking about making sure that you're able to feed your family and have a lifestyle. I would definitely say after 10 years on the PGA Tour, Tiger had enough money and enough clout where he could have done anything he wanted to do. If he never picked up a golf club the rest of his life, he would have been fine. I just can't make excuses for Tiger because you know, the one thing that everybody talks about is how Charlie Sifford was an amazing influence on Tiger Woods and how he named his son after Charlie Sifford. But even if you look at this year's Genesis, this past year, the event that he hosts there in, at Riv, you know, Joseph Bramlett was actually the Charlie Sifford Award winner in that event who we had on here earlier. And if you look at the broadcast, there was no mention of Charlie Sifford. There was no mention of who he was or why there was a significance in having that exemption into that event. And in an event where Tiger Woods is solely in control of that event, to look at his son Charlie every single day and to not even have the decency to mention the man's name who was such a huge influence on him and in his upbringing, that speaks volumes. And it was stuff like that is what goes on where the excuses just can no longer be made for him as an individual. As far as speaking up for George Floyd or even how Jeff commented about the comparison to Muhammad Ali, the truth of the matter is some things are in a person's soul and in a person's spirit. And if Tiger isn't a person who in his soul believes that there is a fight for social justice that he needs to take part of, that he needs to take personal, then it's just never going to come across anything other than scripted. He did. Now, to Jeff's point, it's very, very true. Tiger and his dad did go around and they did do those clinics. My coach actually was a part of one of those clinics here in Orlando. I was not playing golf at the time, but at the OMYGA, and he actually did a book with Tiger, a guy named Dr. Dorsey here. And they did do that, which was very reminiscent of what you would see back in the 60s and 70s with all of your major black sports figures. Dr. J did it. Muhammad Ali did it. All of these people, that was their way of giving back in the day, because there was no Instagram and the opportunity to get around to, you know, the black community as far as news was given. People only told the story when they stuck a camera or a microphone in your face, and they weren't having those opportunities. So Calvin Peet, Lee Elder, Jim Thorpe, they all went around and they did that. And I assume that that would probably be where Mr. Earl Woods got that scenario from. But Tiger was not the first person to go around and do these camps, because Calvin Peet did it time in and time again.
Mariah, you mentioned before how Tiger, in terms of being an inspiration to you, he was particularly seeing a black golfer on your TV screen, as it were. But has he embraced his blackness enough? Do you feel he should have done more with the stage that he had?
You know, it's you know, I always refrain, you know, as a black woman from saying what another black person should have done with their stage, but you know, could there have been a more public and vocal acknowledgement of his blackness, his experiences, and a desire to kind of reach back and bring up the next generation? You know, I mean, I think we can listen to what Maurice has said thus far and kind of identify, well, you know, maybe, yeah, there was some missed opportunity. But then I also think about growing up, actually, there was a junior world championship that was played in San Diego every year. And Tiger had a junior team with his Tiger Woods Foundation that he would financially support to be able to travel from, you know, anywhere within the states, outside the states, for minority golfers to fund them to be able to participate in this event. And I was on that team every year that I played golf growing up. And so I definitely personally benefited from some of the direct attention that he gave to young black and minority golfers through, you know, financial endeavors and supporting them to play that event. But, you know, like I said, that there is just a symbol that he is because he has succeeded at such a high level in his skin. You know, I think that, I mean, I'd be crazy to say that there wasn't an opportunity to maybe be a little more vocal. But it's just tough for me to say what another person should have done if that's not, you know, what they feel called to do. So it's a tough place to look. It's a tough stance to take.
And briefly, Jeff, just before we let you go, just looking a bit into the future, when Tiger Woods eventually does retire, do you feel perhaps he may be more outspoken on social injustice issues and racial inequality, bearing in mind he'll no longer have the constraints of sponsorship and you know, other people around him. Do you think he may well be outspoken on these issues when he does finish?
First of all, I don't think at this point in his life that his association with sponsors has anything to do with why he doesn't speak out. I mean, he, as a number of the participants on this panel have already pointed out, he's way beyond the point of having to worry about something like that. If he wanted to say anything he wanted at this point, he could say it. He's had far more controversial things in his background that might concern his sponsors than something like speaking out about a topic that I think most of the world is more ready for now than ever. I think that, I mean, and I'm saying what I'm about to say purely as his biographer, because these are things that biographers think about when you profile someone else's life, as you try to understand who they are as people. And one of the things that we spent a lot of time describing and showing in this biography of him is that Tiger has always been an introvert. And that started, there were signs of that as early as kindergarten, when he had a really bad stutter and when he was too shy to speak in class. And we interviewed his teachers from first grade on up. This was common all the way through high school. I think that that's part of who he is. Again, this is not an excuse. I'm just saying that when you look at his personality, he has never been someone who's been comfortable not only talking about the kind of serious things we're talking about in the show today, but he's not necessarily comfortable talking about anything. He is an extremely private, secluded human being. Yeah. He has always been that. Not just on this, but on many things. He's not comfortable. He is very comfortable on a golf course playing a game where he has no teammates and he's totally alone. He is incredibly comfortable practicing insane amount of hours all by himself in a game that he can do that in. He's a loner. He is a self-described loner. He has always been that. And I think that you can't just overlook or dismiss that when we're talking about things like, why doesn't he, assume a bigger role in some of this? I think that's part of it. That's not all of it, but it's a factor.
I suppose time will only tell on that matter. Jeff, it's been great to get your insights. Thank you for speaking to us on Sports World. Jeff Benedict, the journalist and co-author of the number one New York Times best-selling biography of Tiger Woods. Well, we've talked a lot about black golf at the elite end of the game, but what's it like at grassroots level? I've been speaking to Vernell Bennett, president and co-founder of the United Black Golfers Association, who's been telling me about the work his organisation's been doing to encourage more black people to take up golf.
We're bringing golf to the community because people don't think that we play golf. We do play golf. We were playing golf all the way back to 1896. We were playing golf. Wasn't recognized in 1966, but we were there. I find that a lot of folks are interested in things, but they are kind of nervous to tackle it because they don't see themselves. So I started doing a little research, and I found out that in the United States, you have about 25 million non-professional golfers. There's only 1 million black. So therefore, when you go out on the course, you got a 95% chance if you go alone, play with three white male strangers. And people are sometimes nervous, but they think that they don't play as well or that it's good. But I learned a long time ago that because you're playing a long time, don't make you a good golfer.
Why is it, do you think, that black participation in golf has been historically low, would you say?
It's low because of exposure. Now, I knew golf existed, but I never saw anybody playing it. I'm talking about prior to Tiger Woods coming on the scene. She heard some names, with all these kind of guys, but you never saw it. So it's not, it didn't hit my interest, because when you're growing up, especially grow up in the city, I grew up in the inner city, we had the typical sports, the basketball, baseball, track, stuff like that. And most things like basketball, you need very little equipment. Baseball, a ball, a stick. If you didn't have a glove, use your hands. Track, needed shoes, sneakers. Mm. You can do what you have to do. But you get into golf, now where do you get to golf? One, you got to have access to a golf course first. Two, you got to get to the golf course because the golf course is not located close. Three, you have transportation to get there if you don't have that. On top of all that, you need golf clubs, you need a golf bag, golf equipment, and money for tee time. So you pull that in a package, it's a little costly to do.
How do you then make the sport more accessible to youngsters who perhaps haven't got the means and the know-how to get into the game of golf?
When a young man came out a few weeks back, he came out, he's about 14 years old, and he said, so his father brought him out. I said, can I bring him out? I said, yes. He brought him out, and now he was on the golf course with 12 to 16 black people all at one time, and his eyes just said, wow, when he's played, what he did, it's the same statistics. So now he liked it, he enjoyed it, so now he got exposure to it. Now, will he keep the game up? Who knows? But he got exposed to it. He see people that look like him playing. Like anything else, you gravitate to something that you can relate to.
Yeah, I suppose this is the thing, isn't it, about golf, is that people see things on television, and if they're not seeing many black golfers, they perhaps don't aspire to necessarily play the game. It's about changing perception, isn't it? And that perception, yeah, has to come from, I suppose, the grassroots level, doesn't it?
Exposure again. When the kids turn on TV station, what do they see? Basketball. 75% of the players are black. Football. 80% of the players are black. They got to see something to be something. They can't sit here and not see things and want to be that. If you watch television and you look at the TV and you see all the times on the TV shows, all the white folks are doctors, lawyers, professionals, right? These are the black folks. You have them playing lower roles, non-professional roles. The kids will say, well, wow, they're on TV. They're successful. No, they're not. Because they see all the roles. We're all the subservient level, not the in charge level. So if you want to be in charge of something, you got to see something to be in charge.
What would you do then if you were in charge? What would be the main thing to attract black golfers, young black golfers, to the sport, to make them pick up a club and play it and really get involved, get interested, as you say, in golf?
You have to bring it to the schools. The schools got to introduce a program for it. And you got to bring the instructors that look like the kids. You got to put it to that young age, make it interesting to them, put it in the schools as a program, and let them learn the game and see people who are teaching the game to them look like it. That's my opinion.
That's Vernell Bennett, president and co-founder of the United Black Golfers Association. Marisa, Mariah, just before we go, just get your love to get your thoughts just finally on how can we make golf more inclusive? What's the way forward, Marisa?
Oh, I was going to let Mariah go first. She's the LPGA.
Oh, you're a gentleman. Go on, Mariah. You're a gentleman. Ladies first. I should know better. Mariah, forgive me.
Yes.
Forgive me.
You know, I appreciated listening to that clip. And I think there are a number of things that we have to do and acknowledge and continue to grow diversity within the game of golf. I think one thing is paying attention to, you know, like you said, the elements that go into one, getting you to a golf course, getting you to equipment, accessibility, and the financial strain that can exist there. And so one of the things that I always highlight when talking about this is it's not actually easy to get funding, even if your parents, you don't come from generational wealth, and your parents are interested in helping you get, grow in the game of golf, it's not necessarily easy to get that funding. And you have all these rules, from the NCAA and higher sports governing bodies, about, you know, how you can receive financial assistance legally. These are in place to protect your revenue generating sports like football and basketball, but they're detrimental to junior and amateur golfers who might need a little bit of extra assistance to continue to develop their golf game. So I think that's one thing that needs to be looked at. And then I think the biggest thing is, another really big thing, not the biggest, is also that representation. And I think when you look at the impact that Sari Park has had on the game of golf, what can we do? You know, when we are put in positions, people like myself, Maurice, Joseph Bramlett, to have that impact
gonna,
and continue to lift up the people coming.
Going to have to wrap this up. But Mariah, great to get your thoughts. Maurice, a quick 10 seconds before we finish.
Quickly, I just started a program where we're going to sponsor black athletes, men and women. We're going to put six scholarships together. So that's what we're doing.
Sorry to keep that tight. You've both been fantastic guests. Thank you so much, Maurice Allen, the first African-American player to become World Long Drive Champion in 2018, and the current LPGA Tour player, Mariah Stackhouse. You've been listening to a BBC Sports World special on the relationship between golf and race.
Sports World is a BBC Sport production for the BBC World Service.